But already doing my studies, I was working at kind of like the intersection between finance and sustainability. I wrote my thesis on financing the green transition in the US. Then went into consulting, mostly around sustainability, environmental sustainability, consulting governments, large companies, then went to the World Economic Forum, again working on how to finance the transition to a circular economy. But it somehow, it never felt like this is it. Right? I had this weird feeling that I'm doing something meaningful, but this is not where I'm supposed to be. And then I think New Year's Eve, a couple of years ago, a friend of mine, Jan Moore, I think some of you know him, now CEO of Chapters, we got to talk. And he was at a point where I said, well, I'll make a lot of money. I want to do something meaningful with it. And basically we said, we both believe in the power of entrepreneurship to change things. And he said, well, if you're setting up a company or something in that space, I'll be your first investor. And that's how I kind of like got into entrepreneurship and then investing. And fast forward a few years later, I set up a company called Uncap. And under Uncap, we have Unconventional Capital, which is an investment fund investing in small and medium-sized companies in Africa. And also a software company called Level, providing operating systems for fund managers. We are the first and biggest client, but now adding more and more clients since we started.
Great, Cynthia.
Sure, good morning. It's great to be here, and thank you for having me, and thank you for leading this panel. I am Cynthia Masri. I'm a managing director at Trinity Church, which is an endowment in New York City. But in terms of my path and career journey, I was quite interested in capital markets and I think probably investing from quite early. I think partly that was a function of, I was born and raised in Tokyo, I'm half Japanese, I grew up going to an international school. And I think through that exposure, that developed kind of an interest in thinking about, you know, how do countries interact with each other, thinking about geopolitics and regulation, and then even within that, how do companies then have kind of in particular multinationals operate within those frameworks? And so I was interested in global markets and thinking about kind of macro flows, whether it was even just, you know, dollar yen and why do currencies move and interest rate differentials. And then quite fortuitously, because I didn't know what to do that in terms of how does that translate into vocation or career, I ended up going to university in the States, and the university I chose was a bit of a kind of feeder onto Wall Street. It is a very finance-focused school, and so through that, and whether it was professors and courses and clubs, I started learning a little bit more about Wall Street. And frankly, that was on the on-campus recruiting in the presence of a lot of the investment banks. And so through my years at university, starting to understand, okay, here are different functions within an investment bank. And the one that interested me the most at the time was sales and trading, because that was very close to the pulse of the market. And so my first job out of school was working for Goldman Sachs in New York. I worked on the public market side doing public equities on the trading floor. And I ended up leaving to go to California. I went to Stanford for business school for a couple of years and then returned to Goldman Sachs, this time in London, where I started working in the principal investing group. My function there was more so on kind of Goldman's balance sheet investments, primarily on the real estate side, whether it's on the private equity side of buying large portfolios and platforms, or on the special situations side and non-performing loans, given some of the market opportunity we saw there, until ultimately 7 and change years ago, I moved over to Trinity Church.
Thank you, April.
I'm a Chinese American immigrant. And then when I was in high school, this is a school that started by 6 or 7 Chinese American veterans from the Wall Street. And I was very luckily the second class that they had, and we only had like 30, 40 kids. So that was how I was introduced to stocks. And they had like an economics class in the final year of my high school. And that was at the end of 2007. So during my paper trading, I thought I was a genius. And comes the second half of my senior year high school, it was 2008. So I lost real money for buying Baidu. So I always wanted to get back to it. So that's how I got interested.
Great. Cynthia, you briefly mentioned Trinity Church, and I think this is a great opportunity for all of you, but Cynthia, you can start to talk about the business and the role you're currently in.
Sure. So I work for Trinity Church, which as context is a historic church organization in Lower Manhattan. The background is Trinity was founded in 1697, and then in 1705, the Queen of England gave the church 215 acres of Manhattan, which ended up proving to be quite a valuable gift. And so subsequent to that, the church ended up either donating or monetizing a lot of that land. But today, if you look at our endowment, about 40% is still in direct real estate. So we are a fairly large asset owner and landlord, commercial property in New York City. And then 60% of it is in what we call the securities portfolio. That's more the typical allocator model where we as LPs invest in funds, including with Rob. It's diversified across geographies and asset classes. And more recently, we launched another portfolio called Mission Investing, which is our impact investing portfolio with the intention of investing in areas that Trinity already does a lot of philanthropy or what our mission areas are. So in terms of my role, I work across the endowment. I serve on the board that oversees our direct real estate. I manage our impact investing portfolio, and then I am a generalist on the securities or the allocator side.
Great. Francisca?
So I'm CEO and founder of the company. As I already mentioned before, so Unconventional Capital is an investment company. We have around 90 portfolio companies, so 90, and we provide revenue-based financing to early-stage SMEs, so small to medium-sized companies. Revenue-based financing is not a very common concept in Africa, and I think also generally there are a lot of challenges in providing debt funding to companies. At the same time, it's urgently needed. So around 10% of SMEs can access financing at the moment. And so we mostly look for companies that have the potential to grow, obviously, into a medium-sized company. We like companies in agro-processing, so that's also currently the deal we're looking at, and also things along the lines and around that, like logistics and financial services and agriculture. It took us quite a while to kind of like figure out how to actually do it, because there is no blueprint in doing it, and you also need to solve a lot of problems outside of your main investment, right? You need to solve for how do I underwrite a company without transparent data and lack of data? How do I collect payments without a functioning credit score that incentivizes repayment? And all those experiences that we made over the 90 investments we've done over the last years across 7 different countries, we've built a operating system for ourselves. So we felt like the only chance we'll have to make this work, especially in that ticket size that we're playing, which is below 100,000, we need to be highly efficient, right? We need to streamline as much as we can, and we need to automate as much as we can. So we've built a software originally for ourselves that just helps us end to end from the first point of contact with an entrepreneur to the last repayment, kind of like trying to automate everything we can, reduce admin and free up time for the team to focus on the touch points that I needed with the entrepreneurs. Seeing that there's a gap in the market, there's a need in the market from other fund managers and companies in the same ecosystem like accelerators and incubators. We started offering that software as a SaaS last summer as well.
Thank you. I think it's so amazing how broad the industry can be. We have a church, we have investment in Africa. April, what about you?
I'm a fund manager based out of Hong Kong. I started Age Over 4 Pi February of 2021, which is literally the peak of China markets. And we managed to grow since then for the past 3 years, despite China is down 45% from where it was. And I think how I got started was initially I worked in investment banking for 2 years, and then I moved on to special sits investing at Goldman Sachs. And then I got to know Mr. David Ma, who started Composite Capital, and I joined him from day one. I worked there 4 years till he decided to sell his business to Seed Limited. And then I was really trying to figure out what's my next move after that experience. And my style has developed into very long-term fundamental investing, concentrated bets, China, which limited my kind of opportunity or very small limited number of funds available that I can work with. And I think it was till end of 2020, early 2021, then I figured out maybe I needed to do it on my own. And then we very quickly, within 2 months, put the money together and opened an account. Literally at the market peak, and that's how I got started.
Great. About the topic of access, maybe to the industry where you are now, what are some challenges that arise when you got started? April, maybe you can take the question.
How I got started with investing early on, or how I got started with the business?
Maybe with the business.
With the business? It was very hard from every angle. You have to convince people that you have the ability to invest, you have to convince people to join you, you have to open accounts with prime brokers that think you're never going to grow, you have to deal with capital allocators that require at least 2 years of investing track record to believe you can do anything. So I think every angle is difficult. So how I dealt with it was, so my mentality has been always like, I don't need everyone to agree with me, but I just need the one that are kind of buying into what I want to do and believing what I can do, whether it's with investors or whether it's with potential analysts or employees. So I got pretty lucky. I had 60 people that were my former colleagues or friends or family that were interested in investing with me and put the money within 2 months. And we were able to get started that way. And then I have four people that I knew from day one before, in my previous work career that want to join me for like no base salary for like almost a year. So that kind of left me with a very low carry cost for the business. And there were no institution with the business. So then I didn't have the pressure to have to deliver every month. So my time horizon for investing become much wider and longer. And everyone that signed up with me from day one had a lockup term of at least 3 years, which takes me to today. And now they're happy, so they're not leaving.
Great to hear. Cynthia.
I guess if the question is in terms of access to the industry, I feel quite fortunate because perhaps I have more of a traditional finance background. And so I think through, going through the typical training programs as an analyst, that was quite easy once you were in the door. But as I look back on the beginning of my career and some of the challenges, I think come 2008, I was working in New York for Goldman on their trading floor. And I think while it felt incredibly challenging at the time, it probably has left some of the biggest impressions in how I think about as an investor going forward. And to almost look at it as fortunate on having the vantage point of being very front and center as a participant and as a witness of just the unraveling of what happened in the great financial crisis and some of the lessons learned from that, whether it was from the market volatility or on the more human side in terms of leadership.
I think for me, actually, because I'm more like an accidental investor, I kind of like fell into the industry by accident, wanting to solve for a problem. Generally, the start in hindsight was much easier than growing the company. And I think that's due to kind of like having that first anchor investor that believed in the idea. and also was able to pull in a few other investors early on. However, so we're investing in Africa because I think next to climate change, Africa is the biggest issue, and you can call it challenge, opportunity, it's probably both, for the next 30 years. In climate change, there's a lot of money going into it, which is needed. But in Africa, it isn't, right? It's still widely neglected. I think 0.5% of private equity goes into the continent. At the same time, the population is going to double, 2.5 billion people by 2050, every fourth person on the planet being African, 42% by 2060 being middle class. That's an insane opportunity, right? That I think especially in Europe, very often we can't really grasp it. And at the same time, we see that that opportunity really needs to be harnessed. And at the moment, that's really, it's not the case. And the only way we're gonna do that is by creating jobs for the 800 million people that are gonna need jobs for the next 25 years. And those jobs need to be created by companies. That's not surprising. And the highest labor productivity you have in medium-sized companies. But you need to be able to grow your company to that level, right? And companies hardly have access to finance. So you have that, so you're looking for investors who see the opportunity in the long term, but also see that in the short to midterm, you need to overcome a lot of challenges to get there. And that's, it's a sweet spot, right? Like you, there are not a lot of investors out there who see it like that, and who can also balance that kind of like ambiguity of maybe in the short to midterm, it's more like an impact investing, impact investment, right? I'm supporting a company to develop a potential solution to a problem. And either it's a huge learning experience that will inform the rest of the market, but it will not be the one who's actually winning in that game, or it will actually be able to benefit from those early learnings and become kind of like a huge investment fund over the next 25 years. And then you also need to have an interest in Africa to begin with. And so I think I've talked to like hundreds and hundreds of high net worth individuals over the last years. And we had some good success in fundraising, but it's just kind of like a tiny percentage of what we need. At the same time, the other investors are the foundations and the development banks. And they are obviously investing with a very different angle, right? And so we've just got money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is fantastic. It's a great name, great credibility. At the same time, that money, of course, comes with very different strings, right? They're very interested in what are the KPIs you're meeting, what is kind of like the ultimate benefit to the consumers of the companies you're investing in. And so you're kind of like pulled between we want to go the commercial way or we want to go the impact way, but you need to play both games because you will need both funding sources to grow your company.
Very briefly, why do you believe there's such an oversight of Africa's opportunity?
I mean, there are other opportunities, obviously. And I think also generally Africa has had a very mixed path over the last 25 years. Just last week, The Economist brought out a new report about Africa. And the report, I think, early 2000s was about, oh my God, this is horrible. This will never work. 13 years later, it's like, okay, this is like a hidden champion. This is a fantastic path. There was a lot of growth happening. And then that growth slowed again, right? So overall GDP growth was pretty flat, although 9 of the 20 fastest growing economies are in Africa. And then you hear these different stories, right? You hear horrible stories from one country that you automatically then start to portray to the rest of the continent. So I think if you want to invest in Africa, you need to understand what you're doing, or invest in people who understand what they're doing. And you need to be able to, in your head, balance those different stories that you hear between, yes, there are challenges that you need to overcome, but there are also opportunities. And both things can be true at the same time. And that, I think, is for people who have not a lot of time, not a lot of interest to invest that time into understanding Africa. It's just not on the top of their priority list.
Okay. The last question from my side before we move to the audience would maybe be to just quickly describe your investing philosophy. Maybe Cynthia, you can start with that.
Sure, and I think, you know, fundamentally, whether types of investments and asset classes you're looking at, there's a lot of things that hold true in terms of investment philosophy and framework. But I would say when you are in the seat of an endowment, I think the goals of that organization and the use of that capital certainly does influence your investment framework a lot. And so to put it in the context of Trinity, it's a church that's been around for over 300 years, and the intention for the endowment is for it to continue to be able to have its ministry for the next 300 years and frankly into perpetuity. And you know, another relevant angle to that is perhaps unlike other endowments that have other revenue streams, whether it's from tuition from students or you know, health bills and payments, for the church, the endowment is really the sole source of revenue. And so that does influence the way we think about the endowment and managing that kind of risk and return. And then lastly, it's very unusual for an endowment to be 40% in one asset class, in particular, indirect real estate, where it is very concentrated in terms of sub-market, sub-asset class, and then illiquidity. And so that certainly also influences the way we think about the entire endowment. But with that being said, I think, you know, ultimately, and perhaps I'll focus more on the allocator side versus if I'm looking at originating a loan or a direct deal, given the fact that I think a lot of this audience is emerging managers or fund managers. And so on the allocator side, while of course we are diligencing and thinking about the underlying companies and exposures and your investment strategies, and that's highly important, ultimately we are also diligencing somebody else's investment process and somebody else's investment decision making. And so there are different elements to it in terms of thinking about, okay, well, how is this organization situated? What do the employees look like? What is the incentives and how are they aligned with us as an LP in particular, as we think about, you know, what does that mean for risk tolerance? And then with the overlay of thinking about, okay, the entire portfolio, how do these managers potentially correlate with each other and the underlying holdings? And so maybe I'll leave it at there in terms of how we think about things.
Thank you. April?
I think there's a bit of evolution in terms of how I think about investing and my strategy. Initially, it was just buy and hold and ride with the good business, and just like it's very Warren Buffett, like the kind of old, younger Warren Buffett style, where like you just wait for the quality business to take you to the next level and ride with the growth. And I think later on, as China market has become more difficult, I couple this with a very stringent investigative fact check system where I diligence and try to figure out what's going on with the business as an outsider instead of talking to the management through an investigative way to understand what's going on with the business in terms of understanding its business momentum. So that layer on top of the quality business growing for a long time, high ROE, good asset allocation methods by the management. So there is a bit of evolution in terms of how I invest. That being said, I don't know, because I'm still young, like it could be not stable and I might evolve into something else, and I'm excited for that.
Francisca?
I mean, I think I already kind of like alluded a little bit to our investment philosophies. Obviously, very different from most investment philosophies in the room. We're only investing in private companies, ticket size below 100K, and we do revenue-based financing debt. So we provide a certain, let's say we provide a 100K investment. There's a multiple on that investment that the company needs to pay over a period of years, and the monthly payment is a percentage of their top-line revenues. And we do that because Africa's markets are not very liquid. And you hear that left and right. And I think that has also contributed to seeing the capital markets as something that's not working very well. Because like getting a company to an exit or a sale was just very hard. So we decided from the get-go, this is one challenge we do not want to have. There will be enough other challenges, but this one we don't want to have. So we're, as I said, mainly looking for companies that can grow over time, where we see that they're in an industry, they have a management, and they kind of like have an edge to other companies that will enable them to grow over time. But we also need to underwrite for behavior. And I think this is where investing in Africa is quite different, because there's, like, as I already said, lack of data. So you really need to figure out, not only will this be a company that has substantial growth, but also will this be a management that is actually will kind of like honor the contract that we have. And so we are more and more looking at behavioral metrics. So we started out actually doing psychometrics. So we've designed our own tests and things like that, but we're now more and more looking for external signals that this is an ownership that has upheld obligations before. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a loan, right? Many of them, we are the first external investor. But it could be that they're just seen as someone who has had an obligation before. It could be as part of a training program, could be as part of a community, could be towards their buyers or their suppliers. But they're someone who generally is kind of like honoring contracts. And then the second part we're looking at is like, are they operating in an economy where we can lock into systems that will make it just a little bit easier to kind of like collect our repayments? And what also is like our proximity to the companies and to other partners in the ecosystem who will have information about that company. So that's why we also, we tried out different things. We're now narrowing onto East Africa because most of my team is based there. And we also see like some of the faster growing economies in Africa are in East Africa. So that's what we're kind of like going with for now.
Thank you very much. And on that note, I would like to open the floor for questions from the audience. I don't know if we have the microphones ready to go.
What's the first question at the back there? Chap with the red jumper.
Hello. Is there anything about being a woman in finance that you wish men in finance understood better?
If anyone wants to jump on that.
I think generally, if you're like, very often there's a question, so what's the edge being like a female investor? And I don't think that there are that many differences, but I do think that there are like personality traits that we see as more female or male, but both genders probably have them. And I think so, we were just more trained to show certain traits and kind of like neglect others. But I think if we were listening to Rob talking about it yesterday, we heard a lot about emotion, having your emotions in check, balance, family. I think those are traits that you would probably a couple of kind of like decades back would have seen as much more female than male. So I think generally it's more about seeing how, if you're playing to both of those personality traits, you will just generally probably have a more diverse and holistic view. And I think, first of all, that I think is important for everyone in the industry to understand that there is not, this is a female investor and this is a male investor, and they're fundamentally different. I think generally when it comes to more like access or opportunities for female investors in the ecosystem, obviously role models, right? I think this is kind of like everyone, and I think everyone here in this room will have their role models that made them who they are. And it could be Warren Buffett, could be kind of like CEOs from The Outsiders. So they're kind of like role models that that basically formed your path to becoming an investor or a CEO. And we do not have a lot of those role models. So I think, first of all, things like that, like you need to put female investors, you need to give them more spotlight. And then second, probably, which is more in private investing, but also probably in fundraising, like networks, right? Like how are networks being built? Who is in your network? And also like how might you lose out on that network for a while? If you are a woman who decides to maybe have a child and you automatically need to step out most of the times for at least a couple of months, you will lose out on a couple of conferences, and also generally will get a little bit harder for you in the future. So like thinking about how can I, as a male investor, make sure that I'm integrating the female investors I know, or I don't know yet, so then you should probably try to know more of them, into my network to make sure that they have kind of like the same exposure to other investors, to potential LPs in their funds than myself.
Do you have anything to add?
Sure. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. And I think, you know, the reality is, I don't think that it necessarily needs to be so differentiated between a female investor and a male investor, because all of us are balancing so many different facets of identity. And it's not like we're showing up to everything as a female investor, this is the stock that I think is interesting. You know, it's not really that cut and dry. But what I think perhaps we could better do as an industry is also think about, everybody is wearing multiple hats and everybody has different things that they're balancing outside of just what their job and career is. And so if I make it personal, you know, one of those things I balance, I have three kids. So as a mother, what I think is helpful is when it normalizes a little bit more workplace integration. And I don't think that has to be because it's a man or a woman who's doing it. I really appreciate the first time I came to this conference 2 years ago, the fact that Rob includes his family. I think that's a great precedent to be setting. I think it's probably also really nice for Rob that he gets to spend the long weekend with his family, and it's probably great exposure for you to be able to even have this sort of access. And so whether it's because you have that role, maybe you have the luxury of managing your own company, but if you don't, maybe it is that, you know, you are managing a team, or you can think about a larger company in ways that, not just for a working mother, but it's also working fathers, on thinking about how can we normalize it and make it a little bit easier for this integration. And perhaps, you know, giving an example of a kid is home sick from school, instead of, does everything need to be in person, or can this become a phone call? Or if it's a video call, is it okay if there's a child in the background? Is it that big of a deal? Obviously understanding that not every circumstance is like that, but I think the more as an industry we work to recognize that everybody has a lot of different things and identities that they are balancing, and to be able to integrate that more, I think would be great.
I think of a little bit as a competitive advantage between male and female. Because to be a successful woman, you can be a successful mother, you can be a successful wife, you can have a successful career. There is more multifaceted than a man whose identity is more tied up to the career than a typical woman, just by societal arrangements, I think. So it's kind of a little bit unfair for men. So I think, if you're in the business of investing, I think as a woman, I'm really here investing just because, purely because I like it. I told my husband I'm not gonna be contributory financially for my family, like you deal with everything. Okay? If my business don't make money, it should be understandable, you know? So like, okay, by default, then my manager doesn't have to be, you know, profitable. So you can allocate more resources for your diligencing and your analyst or whoever that's in the game to make everyone happy. So I think that what we are solving for is a little bit different from men, which I think at the end, it's really about, are you really interested in this? Instead of, I have a 3-year-old son, instead of spending time with your son or spending time with your family. So I think it's about what really makes you a happier person at the end of the day as a woman. And you have to be really honest with yourself. I remember after me giving birth to my son, that was 3 years ago as well, I was really bored at home, because you know, in Chinese culture, you can't go out for a month. And I was like, but the second week, I'm like, I need to get my nails done. If that's something that really makes you happy as an individual, you should just go and do it. I tend to think actually women have more freedom than men in choosing what they want, versus a man's success is more defined by the career identity.
Okay, very interesting perspective. No, I like it. we have time for one more question.
This question was for Cynthia. On the New York City real estate portfolio. I guess one, does that portfolio, how does that work? Does that cash flow back to you all, or is it purely illiquid? And then two, is it mostly, I'm assuming, office? And I guess, what are you guys seeing on the ground these days?
So it is primarily, and by asset, it is developed office, what we would define as Class A office. We do also own some land that is yet to be monetized. We also have a couple of deals that are in the process of development. And so based on that profile, the cash flow differs. But I would say because we already have 6 million square feet of office, that is largely cash flowing. And the way that it works is ideally that then goes to reinvest in the real estate portfolio. And ideally there's excessive cash flow that can then come and go move into the endowment. Normally we have dividends come out of it. The reality is that I think office has been very challenging, and I think that's true as just structurally across the nation, but then also in particular cities in the states, New York included, I would say probably only, you know, behind San Francisco and a handful of other cities. So in terms of how we're managing and we think about it, one of the luxuries that we have, it's very low leverage. And so we are not in this kind of acute crisis of we are gonna lose the buildings. I would say the way that we structure everything is that Trinity retains the fee or freehold. And in the case of a lot of our office, we are the majority equity owner. We own 51% of the leasehold. The rest largely is, with Norges, which has been a great partner in terms of their profile, and you know, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. Look, it's really challenging. I would say that our physical occupancy in that building still, in a lot of those buildings, is still only at 50%. Now that's very different from our actual collection. I think it will be interesting to see as leases roll. What is challenging about office is that there is so much bleed between NOI and your cash flow, and it is a highly intensive kind of capital asset. I could go on forever about office. I'll take it offline. I have a lot of thoughts about it.
Thank you very much to you three, April, Cynthia, and Francisca. And I believe we'll be back at 5 past? Okay, 5 past. Thank you.